Blog Talk Radio.
Are you tired of being sheep? Well, so is he. Get a friend, get informed, and get involved. It's We Are Not Cattle Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to We Are Not Cattle Radio. It is the second day of April, 2013. We're trying to get Mr. Freeway Rick Ross on the line with us. He's going to be our special guest interview today. He's going to talk about who he is, his involvement with Iran-Contra, and what he's trying to do to shape the community currently. So as I try to pull Mr. Ross up, I am going to play, and I'm sure you guys have heard this before, but I'm going to play the greatest speech ever made, try to get Mr. Rick Ross on the line, and then hopefully about halfway through this, we'll be able to come back with some live audio and begin the interview process. So you guys enjoy, and I'm going to try to get him on the line.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls.
Jay, can you hear me?
Barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped
gotcha.
Misery and bloodshed.
You hear?
We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machine.
Okay, I think I got him. Maya, is that you?
Yeah, this is me. Can you hear me?
I got you now. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. If you want to go grab Rick, that'd be awesome. Welcome to live radio, everyone.
He was standing right here. He just walked to the bathroom while I was trying to fix the mic.
Yeah, that's fine. I know he's got to deal with the little ones too. How you doing this morning? Welcome to live radio. Well, good.
I'm fine. Well, the little ones are actually in the bed, so that's a good thing, Rick.
Yeah.
Okay, here he goes, Jake.
Awesome.
Hey, Jake, how you doing?
Mr. Ross, how's it going? Ladies and gentlemen, everyone, the real Rick Ross on the line with us. Mr. Ross, how you doing this morning?
I'm great. We don't have video today.
No, we're just doing audio. I do a radio show, but I was going to let my listeners know that we're going to start doing a televised podcast here in the next couple of weeks. So we're just doing the radio show this morning. We're doing a little live podcast. So we might have some people call in. If you guys want to call in and talk to Rick Ross, you can call in at 602-753-1916. But let's go ahead and set the table, Rick. Let's get a little background on who you are, and then we'll dive into how you got started in this, the involvement when you got, you know, big in the game, and then, you know, the downfall and how you got yourself out of jail, which I thought was the coolest part. But I also want to get into a couple of other segments. So let's start off by who you are and how you got into this game, and then we'll just go from there.
Okay, Jake. Well, you know, my family and I was born in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to California when I was around 3 or 4 years old, and it's ironic that was right during the Watts riot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I grew up in South Central, you know, during the Black Panthers movement, the US, and I had opportunities to go to both rallies, the Black Panthers as well as the US. I was there. He was on fire.
Wow.
In the 60s.
Wow.
I saw the fires myself from my house.
Mm-hmm.
So I really was born at a unique time, I believe, in history. Grew up in South Central. Was there when the gangs first got started in South Central, when the Crips and the Bloods. I remember when they used to have football games against each other before they were enemies.
Wow.
But along the way, Jake, I never learned to read or write.
Yeah, I heard that about, and that and you taught yourself that. Didn't your cellmate teach you how to read and write?
He did.
Okay.
He did. Matter of fact, a couple cellmates helped me along the way. You know, it wasn't just one, it was a couple, you know.
Right.
They all showed me different little techniques of what I needed to learn and, you know, that I should be reading the newspaper and things of that nature.
Right.
So I had quite a bit of help, you know, from guys inside.
Cool.
I played tennis during junior high school and high school. Mm-hmm. Had dreams of becoming the next Arthur Ashe.
Wow.
After the 12th grade, I couldn't graduate because, you know, I couldn't read or write.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't go to college. I had some scholarship offers. You know, I talked to quite a few coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And it was discovered that I couldn't read or write. So it wasn't going to happen. Going to college was no longer an option for me.
Mm-hmm.
So when that was no longer an option, I knew I didn't have the money to go on the tennis circuit. So I had to turn to... Well, I didn't have to turn, but I did. I turned back to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I started hanging out with my little brothers and my cousins and guys I grew up with.
Right.
Well, most of those guys were already gangbanging.
Mm-hmm.
They were already smoking weed. Some were smoking angel dust,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that there. So when I started hanging out with them, I started to see things that I had been away from, you know, playing tennis. You know,
right.
Tennis had kept me out of the neighborhood.
Right, and that's one of the things that a lot of society is starting to push now, almost to an extreme, is that, you know, if you get the kids involved in sports, then they're going to stay away from the streets, like you said. But then sometimes you do get sucked back into that world. So elaborate for us about what happened when you got sucked back into that world and how you got started in the game.
Well, you know, the guys I started hanging out with, one of the guys was named Mike, and he was a guy that I looked up to. He was what we call the big homie.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike was playing football. Matter of fact, he had got a scholarship to San Jose State.
Nice.
But he was back on a break, and he told me that he had something new that was going to be the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I go over... he lays it on the table and he tells me that it's cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of cocaine before other than on the movie Superfly.
Right.
Superfly was the first time I'd ever heard of cocaine, had ever saw cocaine up. It ever come into my radar.
Back then, was cocaine was typically, no, you know, forgive me because I wasn't around that time, but wasn't cocaine primarily a sophisticated white drug, or did that come about later as it grew in popularity?
No, it was already that.
Okay.
It was already that. It was a few blacks that really wasn't white.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, guys like Richard Pryor and
mm-hmm.
Sly and the Family Stone, you mm-hmm. know, we would hear about them getting high.
So it was like an upper echelon drug for the most part. It had like some kind of, upper echelon tent to it, where this is what the people in the know and the people with the money do, right?
Exactly. You hit it right on. You hit the nail right on the head.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that we craved it. We wanted it. I mean, it was almost like getting out of the ghetto. You know,
right?
It was like having this big house on the hill and the Rolls Royce and the Porsche and
right.
And
so that was the way out of, or at least what you saw. Now, when you got introduced to it, now I've watched a lot of movies and documentaries, but when you got introduced to it and then you decided to start selling it, is this like a faux pas that the best dealers, not to get into the criminal aspect of it, but I just look at it as a commodity. You were trading a commodity with people that wanted the commodity. Is it true that the dealers that don't use are the best ones, and they are the ones that rise to the top? Is that true?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you look at cocaine, from my experience being around users, and I stayed with users. I lived in the house with them.
Mm-hmm.
I helped some stop using.
Mm-hmm.
From what they told me, that smoking cocaine was the best feeling that they ever felt.
Okay.
You know, some would compare it to sex.
Mm-hmm.
They say that it just gave you this ultimate feeling, and once you had that feeling, then you would be chasing that feeling for forever. So the thing about cocaine is that And smoking cocaine was different from snorting, because snorting, you could only snort so much.
Right,
because
then otherwise you're going to get, like, nosebleeds and stuff like that.
Right, and then you're going to need surgery, like, you know, some of our black actors did. I think Quincy Jones had to have a surgery on his nose back in the day. Don Cornelius had it, and that was from snorting so much cocaine that that it messed up their membranes in their nose. So, but smoking didn't do that to you.
Right.
I mean, a person could smoke. I've seen people smoke $4,000 of cocaine in one day.
Man, that's good for business.
Yeah, so that was the difference in cocaine, why you couldn't really be a good dealer if you were smoking, because you would smoke up all your profit and all your principal as well.
Now, here's a good question for you. Is that, like, was that your business mentality that set in at that young of an age, saying, looking at this, I'm just saying, from an abject point of view, just saying, okay, well, if we do it this way, then we can only move this much product to an individual. But if we do something to it, and, you know, add baking soda, whatever, which I've seen a lot of interviews that you've done, and I think that you were one of the ones that kind of pioneered that way of transferring it into the powder, into a smokable substance. Is that something that clicked in your brain that said, man, if we can sell it this way, we can make probably, or we can move probably three times as much product, and then, you know, not have the negative side effects for the end user? Is that kind of the way you thought, or was it just kind of a free-for-all, just give the people what they want?
Well, Jake, I wish I was the one who you know, that came up with that idea, but I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
There were people that taught me how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I did was, I was one of the first people from my community that got involved with it,
mm-hmm.
didn't use it, was able to keep yourself off of it, and came up with the idea of compound interest. and taking all my money and pooling it back into the business.
So you basically, you were a true entrepreneur, just using an item that was quote unquote outlawed by government, but you were using true business models at a young age without an education, it sounds like.
I absolutely was, and I figured that out pretty much on my own.
Mm-hmm.
How to be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you watch people doing it, different people doing it, and you see their mistakes, and you say, you know what? Well, I'm not going to make that same mistake.
Right.
So, and then, you know, you want to be honest,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I always like people. I mean, you know, you figure you got a guy who played tennis, so now you got tennis courtesy in the drug business.
Right. Because, you know, when you do get to that level of sports, it takes a massive amount of discipline to get that good, and a massive amount of practice. And what that breeds is, you know, like you said, it's trial and error. You know, you'll probably try three different grips on a backhand and be like, okay, this is the one that works for me, trial and error. Or,
absolutely.
You know, the same thing with a forehand. So you just applied your real-world knowledge to the game. And so now we've taken it from you're getting started out, you're starting to build a business. And where did it go from there? What did it do to your community when you started doing this? Did it bring, you know, because...
Well, from the beginning, Jake, it looked like I was Robin Hood from the beginning.
Okay. Now, how so?
Well, you know, in my community, there was no jobs.
Mm-hmm.
There was gang violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guys fighting with each other,
mm-hmm.
over, you know, petty stuff of colors and neighborhoods and cars and just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the drugs started, now there were jobs in the community.
Right.
There was reasons for people to cooperate with each other. There was reasons for people to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that really, I mean, I know it's a bad thing to say, but I believe that the drugs was the first peace treaty. You know, that was the first time after the Bloods and the Crips started fighting that you could see Bloods on Crip streets and Crips on Blood streets and them working together, you know, to beat the police and to build a better business.
Now, when I heard you talk before on some other shows, you talked about how it was kind of a calming effect, and I know that people are probably listening to it going, what the heck are you guys talking about, a calming effect? But if you can extrapolate this, everybody, my listening audience is pretty smart. Think about this. If you can take something that is very profitable, provides jobs, and then you talked about how they didn't want murders, they didn't want gang violence because that's going to bring the police in. So what you wanted to do was kind of act as an underground commerce, I guess, and try to stay out of the limelight because, you know, with the limelight comes the heat and all that other stuff. Is that pretty accurate to say that?
And you hit it right on the nail right on the head again. We tried everything we could to keep violence down, to keep crime in the neighborhood. We were totally against violence and crime, other than selling drugs.
Well, and that's what I'm trying to get across to the audience is that they, you know, the mainstream and all these other media outlets are going to portray drug dealers as gangbangers. And you and I both know why they do that. They do that to destroy the inner city culture, to destroy the black community. And, you know, there have been documents leaked out about with MTV and all these other high-end music execs about pushing gangster rap. And I've heard you talk about that before. It just seems like it's one of those things that's kind of a faux pas, I guess, if you will, to say, well, drugs actually brought crime down, or bringing this to the community actually bettered the community. So let's elaborate on that and talk about the methods that you guys use, not to get into too much detail, but trying to keep it on the hush and just provide everybody jobs. And then let's talk about, you expanded your empire and you were, you know, and then we'll get into Blandone and all that stuff.
Okay, well, how I figured that it bettered the community because it gave us a chance to do things that we didn't normally have the resources to do. You know, Jake, to be honest with you, if I go in, I had a 750 biker score, the first time I ever had a credit score. I never cared about credit other than the credit that I got from my supplier in the drug business.
Right.
But I went into the bank and applied for a credit card,
mm-hmm.
and I had a 750 FICO score,
mm-hmm.
and they turned me down. And that's how it's been all our life is that, you know, we're not getting credit. We're not getting the thing that some of the other people get,
mm-hmm.
and we believe it's because we've been redlined.
Mm-hmm.
So the drugs don't redline nobody.
Right.
The drugs go with whoever is taking care of business. It don't care if you're green, black, purple.
Right.
It don't matter. It don't matter where you're from. If you take care of your business and you do the right things, you can flourish in drugs. And you know, Jake, I believe that the drugs is an economical crime. I don't believe it's a crime of violence, a crime of vicious intent, ill will. I think that it's plain and simple. It's a crime of economics. It's
yep.
a crime of a guy not being able to take care of his family and seeing that here's this opportunity that people want to get high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want to get high.
Yep.
And what's wrong with a person getting high? If that's what they want to do with their life. If somebody wants to throw their life away, I mean, who am I? Or anybody else to say, you know, I can't get high. I mean, right now, you know, I just finished dealing with a kid from Oregon University,
mm-hmm.
and this kid smoked weed.
Mm-hmm.
They kicked him off the team. The kid was one of the best DBs in the country. So because he smoked weed, now they're going to tell him, you can't make a living.
Well, I think that you and I take the exact same approach on, and I don't want to say it's a libertarian perspective. I just think it's being real, and you have to eventually look at it. And one of the things that you said in your interviews that I thought was so profound is that you looked at cocaine as a way to get freedom, and that's exactly what you just described. You're free of the credit system, so you don't have to rely on, you know, some number cruncher to say that, oh, well, you got a great credit score, but we're still not going to give you squat. You know, it's going to give you the ability to grow and protect your family and to you know, like you said, if it's not harming anybody else, who cares what that person does? If they want to go into their house and freebase heroin, not that I am advocating that or you're advocating that, but that should be their right as a human being, like you said. If they want to destroy their life, then that's their prerogative. As long as you don't get behind the wheel of a car or do something dumb like that, I really don't have an issue with it. Now, transferring, you know, from that, how did you, when you said that cocaine was your ticket to freedom, How did that transpire? Like, no, so now you're helping the community out from a microscopic perspective. You know, the microeconomy that you're building within the community has now probably got to take some kind of shape, and you're probably going to have to move into bigger and bigger things in order to keep up with demand, all that kind of stuff. Is that kind of what happens? Is that you don't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to move $2 million worth of cocaine by the time I'm 25. It just kind of snowballs and happens. Is that what took place?
Exactly. You know, we start off, I was making maybe $50 a week sometimes $200 a week, and then it just kept growing. You know, it went from $200 a week to $1,000 a week, from $1,000 a week to $5,000 a week, and then from $5,000 to $10,000, and from $10,000, you know, $100,000, and it just keeps growing. And you know, Jake, I was so excited about what was happening to me is that I started trying to better myself in the drug business just like I would do when I played tennis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would work on my backhand, I would work on my forehand, my serve, my overhead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the drug business, I worked on it the same way. I tried to figure out, you know, what I could do to make my game stronger.
So you're like the actual oxymoron. You were the ethical drug dealer, I guess.
Absolutely. I'm the kind of drug dealer, Jake. You know, when you look at it,
mm-hmm.
I know that anybody can sell drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely anybody. They don't have to know. Jake, I didn't know what it smelled like. I didn't know what it looked like. I didn't know how to work a scale.
Mm-hmm.
I knew absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And people that was using drugs taught me
right. Everything
that I needed to know. So that could happen to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about what the when you got big and you started dealing with Blandone, how did that relationship come about? And then expand on, you know, obviously you get into the Iran and the Contras and all that stuff, but let's talk about Blandone really quick and how that relationship formed. And from what I gathered from you, he was all just about the bottom line profit. He was all about the money. Is that pretty much accurate?
Yeah, pretty much. I met Blandone through a teacher,
mm-hmm.
And a friend,
mm-hmm.
Somebody I played tennis with, and I confided in him. You know, he was somebody that I looked up to as well,
mm-hmm.
and I had a lot of respect for. I mean, he was doing well. You
mm-hmm.
know, he had a house up in Lower Baldwin Hills. He drove a Cadillac. He had mm-hmm. jewelry. He was black, and he looked like one of the movie stars.
Right. And then that kind of fueled your fire to once again saying, hey, this might be, just like you said at the beginning of the broadcast, this might be my ticket out of here.
Absolutely. Well, I hung out with him because I was always looking for, you know, I didn't have my father.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that I was missing a void of somebody to really teach me the things that I needed to know to better myself.
Right.
And I didn't know who to pick as a role model either. You know, only thing that really mattered to me, did it look like you was being successful? I mean, you didn't even have to be successful. If you just looked like it to me, then that was a sign of success. You
right.
know, if you drove a nice car and you had a house and some jewelry, to me,
mm-hmm.
you were on top of the world.
Because mm-hmm.
you're talking about a kid that went to school with holes in his shoes. You
right.
know, I used to have to tape tennis balls to my shoes to keep my feet from touching the ground. All my socks had the same hole in them.
Wow.
So when you're talking about a guy that's driving a brand new Cadillac and he had jewelry and he's standing up in the hills, this guy's made it.
Mm-hmm. So you get introduced to Blandone and you guys start doing business together. Did you have any idea what was going on with the funding and all that stuff and how it was getting funneled back through the CIA? Did you have any idea?
Absolutely not. It became a time that he did tell me that they were fighting a war in their country and they were trying to get their land back. But that was as far as it went.
Okay. So, I mean, now at the epitome or at the peak, how much business were you guys doing? Just to give everybody kind of a rough estimate.
We've done $3 million a day. We did that for about 3 years. For about two years. And that $3 million, that wouldn't happen every day.
Right.
But there would be days that we would do $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
There would be days we do $1.2 million. Mm-hmm. There'll be days we do $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. There'll be days we do $2 million. So we did that for like 2 years straight.
Mm-hmm. So now you have all this money and you're, you know, self-made. What does Rick Ross do with all that money?
I'm buying businesses. Mm-hmm. I'm buying businesses to get out of the game.
Mm-hmm. Now did Blando know that you were buying these businesses in order to try to get out of the game?
Yeah, you know, I modeled my career kind of on a Superfly.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever saw Superfly, but Superfly got out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he beat the man. I knew that the man was going to try to take me down because I saw him try to take Superfly down in the movie. So I know in my mind that he doesn't want me to win.
Right.
So my goal is to beat him and to get out the game just like Superfly did. You know, I watched Superfly 2 and 3 times a day when I got in the drug business. That was the only video that I had in my house. You know, I had a VCR. I was probably one of the first people in Los Angeles with a VCR. And, you know, it was very few movies out.
Right.
Superfly was one. And I watched that movie over and over again, and I studied him. And you know, it's crazy how sometimes people, you know, fashion their life after a movie star.
Oh, absolutely. It still happens to this day. But, you know, using that as kind of art imitating life, and even in the reverse, You basically took that as kind of a playbook. So what kind of businesses were you buying? That's pretty interesting. What kind of were you buying? Like dry cleaners or what were you buying?
I had bought a motel. I bought a custom tire and wheel shop. I had a car wash. I had a beauty salon. I had a tire store. I had a junkyard. I had a body shop.
Wow.
I had apartment buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I bought an old theater. What else?
Okay, so you've got all these things going, and I'm sure you've got people to help you run your businesses or whatever. So let's talk about the day that everything hits the fan and that you get pinched. What goes through your mind? Is it something that you're kind of in the back of your mind anticipating, or has this come as a complete shock to you?
Yeah, I'd always made up my mind that I was going to have to go to jail. I didn't feel that a guy should do what I did and get away with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, should be so lucky that he shouldn't have to pay some price. So I was perfectly willing to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked at the amount of time that they were giving.
How much time did they give you?
Well, when I went, I didn't get the time that I was looking at, but when I went, they were talking like 40 years.
Okay.
I was 28 years old.
Whew. So they got you for 40 years on a nonviolent offense, and then I heard something. So now Rick Ross is in jail, and what does Rick Ross begin to do in jail, and how do you once again, you said that a bunch of your cellmates helped you out. What starts happening? You start learning how to read. What really caught my mind and my eye is when you started talking about that you started studying the law. And that, to me, was fascinating because is that something that goes on a lot, or is that something that kind of just a few guys pick up in jail? They pick up a book and start reading, or they pick up, you know, some you know, old, you know, like, I guess, Black Law's Dictionary or something like that and start learning the law. What is it like for the first couple of years of you being in there?
Yeah, what it's like for me, it was the first time was tough, you know, getting used to being confined inside such a small area. It was really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, you start to adjust.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I found out from being in custody about the human being is that we adjust to almost any situation that we put in.
Yeah.
So my mind and my body started to adjust to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came to my attention that the way out of jail was through the law library.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started reading and studying and get myself together.
Right. And then you got yourself out of prison, correct?
Correct. I'm the one that found the issue that got me out.
Now, what was the loophole, but what was the issue that got you out?
Well, you know, I went to jail twice, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I went to jail, what got me out was the cops in my case had become crooked. They had started stealing money from us, torturing people, handcuffing you, beating you in the head with flashlights. If you get up close to me, you can see I got a bunch of scars in my face.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those scars are from police brutality. It's from when I was handcuffed and I was beaten in the head with a flashlight. I was handcuffed and I was my feet were also tied.
Okay.
And the cops let the dog bite me all on my legs.
Oh.
And beat me all in the head with flashlights. The other cops had also planted drugs on me and had lied and had fake search warrants and all kind of different stuff. So they couldn't go to trial with those guys.
Okay.
It would have made a mockery of the system. So I wind up getting 5 years from that sentence. That's the time they offered me the 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as soon as I got out on that case, Danilo had apparently went to prison. But I had cut off all ties with Danilo when I was in jail.
Okay.
You know, I had already stopped selling drugs. I stopped selling drugs a year before I went to prison.
So when you get out, what year is it when you get out?
94.
Okay, so that was the first time. The second time, were you still incarcerated when the Gary Webb stuff came out, correct?
Right, I went back to prison. Okay. What happened is as soon as I got out, Blandon was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
He caught the case while I was in prison during my 5 years.
Okay.
So when I get out, the government pays him a bounty to go and get me.
Unbelievable. Okay.
So even though I'm not selling drugs, have no hope of selling drugs, I'm doing the record business now.
Right.
I had saw, you know, guys like Suge Knight and Death Row, and I said, you know what, that I can do a record business and I can make it successful just like Suge did.
Right.
So I started trying to do records.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they sent Blandon to me, you know, telling me stuff like, man, why are you out here trying to get money from these people? Nobody's going to help you. You know, I was trying to build a youth center for kids.
Mm-hmm.
Where kids could come. I was hoping to build a bridge between the ghetto and mainstream society.
Right.
Where, you know, guys like Magic Johnson and other people would have the heart to come to South Central and mingle with the kids. Because, you know, people like that, they don't come to our community. We don't know what it takes to become like a Magic Johnson.
Right.
You know, you have to try to figure it out on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to make it so we don't have to figure that out anymore.
Okay.
So we absolutely know what to do. Well, in between that time, the government sent Danilo over there to get me involved in drugs. So
mm-hmm.
first he came over and he was trying to get me to sell drugs. And I told him, no, I'm out of the drug business. I don't do it no more. I'm
mm-hmm.
done. So this went on for like 6 months, him calling me, begging me, pleading, you know, oh, I got drugs, I'm stuck with 700 kilos of cocaine, and I don't know what to do, the Colombians is tripping, and I got to get this money, please help me, you're my friend, why mm-hmm. wouldn't you help a friend when a friend is in need?
Mm-hmm.
Well, during this time, one day he catches me, and I'm riding with one of my little partners from back in the day,
yep.
who's still in the game,
mm-hmm.
and I knew he was still in the game. This guy had been, you know, helping me with my record company. He was talking about, you know, coming in with me, helping me form my record company, and he was going to get out of the game
mm-hmm.
And go in the record business with me. So we were riding around, and Danilo called, and he heard the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So what he said is, Rick, let me do everything. I'll take care of it. You don't have to do nothing. You can just sit back and just give me the connect. Well, I introduced him to Blandon, and then when they got ready to do the deal, Blandon told him, well, we need Rick here.
Oh, Jesus.
So he called me and he said, Rick, Danilo not going to take the money unless you here. He don't trust me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came and Chico gave him the money, police helicopters come up off the ground and squad come out. They probably spent $500,000 arresting us that day.
So basically, he sets you up, and he makes it so that you have to come in, and, you know, I don't know you, so I want to, you know, it's the old, you know, handshake routine. Like, I don't know you, but I've shook hands with you, so I'll do business with him, and as long as you're there, we'll do business together. And then you get pinched, and so he basically sells you out to the cops for a bounty. What happens to Blandone? Where does he go from there?
For a while, he was here in the U.S. On the street, you know, still selling his drugs and setting people up.
Oh, good for him. So he gets to ruin lives and escalate in the drug game and ruins other people's lives and sends them to prison for 40 years.
Right. I got a life sentence on that one.
So you got the second time, you got life sentence. So now you're in jail for life. And then do you start, and is this where you start to get really involved in the law? And I also wanted to touch on, briefly, you said before that you were in lockup for 40 days or whatever it's called. I guess it's called isolation or what do they call that, where they put
we
you
call
in
it the hole, the chute.
Now, what goes through, and I know this is going to probably take you back to some really bad memories, but what goes through a person's mind? Because as a human being, knowing the human psyche like I do, isolation is the absolute worst torture that you could ever give to somebody with no contact with humans, no music, no books, no nothing. What goes through your head after 40 days of being in the hole?
Man, it's tough when you start. You know, the first couple days are like forever. Seems like 10 years one day. But once you're there, you start to soul search. You start to go back over your life, and I think that really helped me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being in there, because I start to look back over my life. Because you only have you, so you're in there and you got to deal with just you. And
mm-hmm.
you got to learn to deal with just you.
Mm-hmm.
And what I started to do was going back over my life to figure out how I got in the position I was in. You know, what was you doing in solitary confinement? What had you did that was so bad that they put you in solitary confinement?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I saw that I did wrong was that I became really, really successful at. Not that I'd ever beat anybody up,
right.
Not that I'd ever shot anybody, not that I'd with the cops, but that I just became so successful in drugs that I had defined their whole concept.
Mm-hmm.
So and that was the reason that I needed to be in solitary confinement. But for myself, I felt that I needed to be in solitary confinement so that I could find out who I was and what I should be doing with my life.
That's an incredible story, the fact that you did all that soul searching, and then the only thing that you come up with after 40 days of soul searching is that you were selling a product that wasn't quote-unquote sanctioned by your government so that they could get a cut of it, and so that's the only thing that you've done wrong. Now, people are going to argue and say that, well, you destroyed people's lives, and I think that you mentioned one time that you got on a guy's radio show and he said that you were the devil. Now, I don't think that you're the devil. I think that the person that has the issue with the drugs has the devil inside of them. But that's a side issue. So
you know what, Jake? I'm glad you brought that up, because nobody, you know, a girl come to me one day. I was speaking at a speaking engagement, and she wanted to blame me for her father's drug habit. And I say, listen, that's the problem.
Yeah.
You have to blame your father for his drug habit.
Yeah.
I've never put a gun in anybody's head and told them to take drugs. I never went to anybody and for the first time and had never used drugs and never touched drugs and said, hey, I got this wonderful drug.
Mm-hmm.
Start taking it.
Yeah, you got your choice. You either snort this or I'm going to blow your head off. That never happens. But
it never happens, Jake. I've never convinced anybody to start using drugs. Never. Not one time.
Well,
my whole life.
And that's one of the things that, see, you took it to the other extreme, and you had people that were, that you knew closely that were using, and you're like, listen, you can't keep doing this. This is going to destroy you. Even though you were.
Jake, I told everybody that. I told, no, I didn't tell them, because I didn't know it was going to destroy them, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't say it's going to destroy you. But what I did tell them is that if you want to have money, you cannot use drugs. I did learn that, and I did tell people, everybody that I came in contact with. You cannot, because it was people that was using. Jake, you want to know something that's really, really crazy?
What's that?
In my mind, and I believe that everybody that uses drugs really wants to be the dealer.
Well, they want to be, and that's a human trait. Most people want to be, they want to feel like they're in control. So the only way that you can feel like you're in control of that kind of environment would be is if you're at the top of the pyramid, controlling the flow of the product and controlling how much that you use. So I would agree with you 100% on that point. And one thing that gets me, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was talking to my wife. She was turning on the blender.
That's all right. Now here's one thing that I wanted to get into. You get yourself out of prison. Tell me what you did and what you found. Was it like an aha moment, or was it like, oh my God, look at this, I can get myself out of here? How did my attorney and my prosecutor or how did my defense attorney not know this stuff?
Well, you know, Jake, my attorney told me something one day, and it really stuck with me, and it really put me on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, he said, Rick, anytime somebody else wants for you something that's going to be good for you more than you want it for yourself, then you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And you know, Jake, I use that right now when I go to the schools and I talk to these young people.
Mm-hmm.
And I let them know that if you think that Obama is going to come down and clean your neighborhood up, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
See, you got to take it up on yourself to come out and clean your neighborhood up. You got to come out yourself and clean your country up.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sit around here and wait on nobody else to come and do something for you that you should be doing for yourself. And my attorney, he told me that, and I think that was the most valuable lesson that he ever taught me.
Well, it's funny that people learn that in different ways. I learned that because, not to toot my own horn, but, you know, if you took exactly what you just said and applied that to me about a year ago, that's exactly what happened. I got so frustrated with people not knowing what was going on in the world, not knowing what's going on in our legislature, not knowing what's going on with our civil liberties, not knowing what's going on anywhere, that I got tired of telling people, just saying, hey, you know, look, we need to talk about this. And they just, you know, if it's not football or if it's not sports, it's not, you know, aesthetically pleasing to them, they're just going to switch off. So I decided, I was like, listen, I'll just start a radio show and a website and put all my information out there. And when I start talking to people, just say, hey, go look at my website or listen to my radio show. You're going to learn something. And then that's the kind of action that we need. And I'd love to see that you're on the grassroots, somebody that's been in the game, seen every angle that the game has to provide, and now you're coming back and giving the people what the real deal is. And the real deal is nobody's going to do anything for you. You have to do this for yourself. And the only person that you got to live with after you do all this stuff is yourself. I mean, is that kind of the overarching message that you give to the kids now and just say, listen, like you said, Obama's not going to help you, especially out in California. You know, Dianne Feinstein's not going to help you guys. So you got to help yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's so amazing, Jake. I go to a guy who he calls me to come down and speak to his kids. He has a program for kids who use drugs,
mm-hmm.
and he asked me to come down and speak. Jake, they pay this guy, Jake, something like $70,000-$80,000 a month to counsel these kids. And Jake, the guy knows absolutely nothing about drugs. I'm like, they won't even give me gas money to go to the schools and talk to the kids. So I'm like, these people just, if you don't have a degree of their liking,
no, yeah,
they don't want to bother with you.
Well, here's the one thing that I thought that you said that was so profound, and I experienced this in my own life, but it's a different facet, but it's the same kind of thing. You said one time that you believe that, here, let me find this exact quote here. You said before that the drug war is like a machine that feeds itself and then chews up little black people and spits them out. Now, I was involved in another machine that's called corporate America. And corporate America does the exact same thing. It takes individuals, turns you into a number, chews you up, and spits you out. Because I was in sales, so I lived month to month. I could absolutely blow out my quota one month and be the world hero, and then the next month, if I don't, you know, hit the same number, then I'm probably going to get let go or fired or put on PIP or something like that. It's the same kind of concept. But elaborate on that quote of what you meant, that it just gets sucked up. Is it because there's no other alternative, or do they see that as a way out, or is it kind of a combination of everything?
Well, what I believe is that there's a lack of jobs in America. So mm-hmm. one way of creating jobs is to create laws.
Mm-hmm.
And once you create laws, then you create jobs, because now you got people who are going to have to be the judge. You got mm-hmm. the bailer.
Mm-hmm.
You got jury.
Mm-hmm.
You got the prosecutor. You got a lawyer. Then you got jailers. Then you got to hire buses
mm-hmm.
to transport the people to the prison. Then you got people who have to build a prison. Then you have the people who have to supply the food to the prison. So what you do is you create a whole industry. You know, right now the American prison system is on Wall Street.
Oh yeah, it's all privately run, and that came out in that secret meeting documents. Did you read? I'm sure you read that about how, you know, they get all these big record execs and everybody's in there, and they say, okay, here's the deal: we're gonna push gangster rap to destroy the culture and fill these private prisons. We're gonna brainwash little people and to make them think that it's cool to go out and shoot people. It's cool to go out and do drugs, not as a way to, like you said, progress your area or supply people with things that they want. They use that as a force of, look, if you go out and you sling drugs and you shoot people, you're going to end up like Jay-Z or 50 Cent or somebody like that.
And you get to sit with the President of the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And now, here's the one thing that I get from all of this stuff that goes on. What do you think, and I heard you mention something about this before, but I think that this is a real challenge in our society where you're starting to see people become what I like to refer to them as brand whores. You know, somebody that's going to have, like, my perfect example is that Obey crap that's out there, and they put all kinds of Illuminati symbology and stuff. Whether you believe in that stuff or not, they put it on their shirts, and it's like Obey. And the shirt probably cost them $2 to make, but it looks really cool, and the graphic looks really cool. So the kid's going to go spend $20, $30 just because it's got a graphic on it.
No, and $50.
Yeah, I was trying to be conservative. But so do you think that that's another piece of the pie, is that you start to see all of the propaganda, and propaganda doesn't mean, you know, government pushing anything, guys. It's just propaganda is anything to make you think a certain way or think the way that the retailer wants you to.
I study
marketing for 5 years, and I see this stuff that's getting pushed. Like, I see this stuff on the sitcoms that's getting pushed. I see this stuff on, you know, just in trendy little ads that are getting pushed. Now, do you think that that reflects back onto the urban community? And I hate using that term urban, but let's just use it for time being.
Absolutely.
Do you think that reflects onto the urban community and pushes people into that gangster culture and then feeds the private prisons?
Absolutely. I mean, what I see happening now is the people that can least afford this stuff, they're selling them the cheapest thing that they can find, and only, like you say, because they put a brand on it. They mm-hmm. make it like, if you don't have this, you're not important.
Right.
You don't matter.
Right.
And as we already know, and you said earlier, everybody wants to matter. Everybody wants to be important. Everybody wants to control their destiny or their situation. So when you put this stuff on there, you know, I go to these schools and I see little black kids who are in the project. I know they're in the project. I know they probably don't have a father at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I see them wearing these Air Jordans that mm-hmm. cost $200 or
mm-hmm.
or the different things. That they just can't afford, or they shouldn't be affording. You know, they should be buying books with that money to get real knowledge. They're just not giving it. And, you know, I spoke at a school a couple weeks ago, and I spoke in the library. And
mm-hmm.
so while I'm at the school, I got there about 20 minutes early. So what
mm-hmm.
I said is, let me walk around the library and see just what they have these kids reading.
Mm-hmm.
And there were not one self-help book in the library. You know, not one book where they were telling the kids to be entrepreneurs, to be free thinkers, to be critical thinkers. It just wasn't there.
Well, because they get sold on the hive mentality, and they get sold on this fact that if you go along to get along, everything's going to be great and everything's going to be peaches. But you and I both know that it's a farce. When you really start living and when you really start appreciating things that people do and things that you do, it's because that you got outside of the box. It's because you are a free thinker. It's because you're going to take your own path. And what you see Do you see this in the culture of the kids? Because my wife's a school teacher, so I hear, you know, I hear secondhand about what's going on, and I always like the anthropology of what's going on with the kids. What are the kids talking about? What are the kids doing? And she says that there's just such a disconnect with people just interacting with one another because everything's over Twitter or over text. What do you see reflecting in these younger communities, and where do you see that kind of impact coming into play as far as people not wanting to interact with one another and just go along with whatever's trending?
Well, I think that we're losing a valuable a tool, because interacting personally with people, you know, the touch is one of the best ways that we can connect.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, you know, I read a couple books when I was in jail, and they talked about whenever you're talking to somebody, if you can touch them, they'll understand you even better than if you don't touch.
Oh yeah.
So I think that we're losing a valuable tool by disconnecting with each other, and we lose feelings for each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if something happens to you and you're on the other side of the world, it really doesn't matter to me.
Well, that's the greatest segue into what I was going to ask you. Is that you now have media, you know, dictating reality to the people, other than, you know, people that are off stream like myself and Adam, that are trying to make a difference and bring humanity together and say, listen, you know, just because it happens over there, just because a drone goes over to some foreign land and kills 200 people, doesn't mean that that's right. Just because you can't see it, touch it, feel it, that doesn't mean that that's right. And I think that what you're going to see is either society is going to awaken, and we're all going to progress in a very rapid manner towards, you know, becoming unified, and not talking about like a one world government, but humans becoming unified. Now, just out of my curiosity, because I want to really get this, what was it, and kind of backtracking a little, so sorry about this, what was it that got you out? What specifically did you do that got you out and got you out on good behavior?
Well, it wasn't good behavior that got me out. They don't care how good you are in prison.
Fair enough.
What got me out, Jake, was they had charged me with
three-strike law,
basically being a career criminal.
Uh-huh.
And the way they do it, the way they did me, let's go with how they did me first.
Yeah, sure.
When I got arrested that first time, they took me around the country.
Mm-hmm.
I got a free plane ride and free bus ride around in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They took me to every state that they could prove that I'd sold drugs in.
Okay.
And even though I'd been found guilty and I wasn't going to get any more time, what they all wanted was to convict me. They all wanted to take me in for the prosecutor to say, let me tell you what one of the prosecutors told my lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He told my lawyer that before he would drop the case, he would rather take me to trial and lose than to just drop the case on me. So what he wanted me to come in court and say, yeah, I committed this crime in Texas,
mm-hmm.
and he got the conviction.
Oh, so he wanted the glory.
He wanted the glory. So, and I wasn't going to get any more time. That's all they wanted to do. So when they said that, you know, I said, you know what? What the heck? I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd already made up my mind anyway. I was never going to sell drugs again.
Yeah.
So what they did is they take me to like four different places, and they do that. and they give me convictions. So now on my record, if you look at my record, I got all these convictions.
Mm-hmm.
But I've only been in jail one time. I never got out of jail. I never physically got out of prison.
Okay.
They just took me from state to state, but I was always in handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got out, and what the government did, they figured, you know, when they get Danilo to set me up,
mm-hmm.
now they can give me the life sentence that they wanted to give me.
Mm-hmm.
So when they arrest me, they charge me with being a career criminal, a three-striker.
Okay.
So I go in and I start reading the law books because, you know, I felt I was a three-striker too because
mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the law.
Oh, yeah.
But I got fortunate that the people who originally wrote the laws understood. You know, they were thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said is that in order for it to be a strike, that a guy has to go to prison, No, let me back up a second. A guy has to commit a crime,
mm-hmm.
go to prison, and get out.
And then do it again.
That's one strike. Once he's out, he has to commit another crime, go to prison, and get out.
Okay.
Now he has two strikes.
Gotcha.
Now, if he commits another crime, that's three.
Now, see, from just what you and I said before, you've only had two strikes, correct?
Well, I didn't have, right now I got two strikes, yes.
Yeah, okay, but at that time you only had one strike because they kept pushing you around and saying, yes, guilty, 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 right?
Right, but they wanted to make those, each one of those strikes.
Good try, guys. Unbelievable.
Because Jake, it's not really about embettering our community. Jake, they say it cost them like $1.2 million to take me to trial.
Oh, they're going to make that up, no problem, on the amount of money that they're going to get from the taxpayers by having you in the private prison.
So, Jake, they could have came over and gave me a job.
True that, yeah, I hear you.
You know, they could have paid me, you know, they could have said, Rick, we'll pay you $50,000 a year not to commit no crimes,
mm-hmm.
to go out here and work with the kids, to clean the community, clean mm-hmm. alleys, paint walls,
mm-hmm.
and spread that money out, and they would have had somebody that would have been advocating for them.
Right. So at the very end, so you find out about the three strike law, is that what you come to the table with and just say, hey, I never got my three strikes because I never served time and then got out and then committed another crime, got convicted, and got out, correct?
That's what I told them, and then they said, oh, well, that don't count for you. Yeah. Right now.
I'm sorry to laugh, but that just seems like such lawyer legalese right there.
And then look what they say, Jake. They said it didn't count for me because my convictions was from different states.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what threw me. When they brought that up, I was like, oh, wow. And then you're thinking that these people are so smart. These people have been to Harvard, Yale, and the judge was the chief judge in San Diego. So I'm like, wow. If all three of them say that, I might be wrong.
Right, right. But
majority rule thing, you know, right, again, right. You know, if everybody is doing it, it must be right.
Right.
But, you know, some told me to keep digging,
mm-hmm.
and then I found it.
That's awesome. So now what do you, we got like 2 minutes left. What do you do now? I know you do work with the kids. Let's go ahead and promote some of the stuff that you do. And then when I'm going to upload this, everyone, to YouTube. So check out the YouTube channel, We Are Not Cattle TV. I'm going to upload this with pictures of Rick. I'm going to upload it with some links to his website, his links to his social media. So let's talk about what you're doing to better the community and how you're trying to build an empire on the correct side, per se, and I use that in quotes, on the correct side of the law.
Well, you know, right now I have a silk screen shop where I do T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm employing young people. Right now I got about 60 young people that I'm teaching how to go out and sell T-shirts. At a fair price to the people,
mm-hmm.
and give them a good quality T-shirt. Because you were talking about that T-shirt early. Well, those T-shirts that those guys use cost about 75 cents. They use They use the cheapest tee you can find. I'm using a really high quality tee on my shirts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm teaching the kids how to silk screen. I'm also starting a graphic site for graphic designers that want to design T-shirts. So if there's anybody out there to design T-shirts, tell them to get at me. We need that, too. Also, I got several web properties, Freeway Mixtapes, Freeway Social Media, and I'm working on a movie. You know Nick Cannon's going to play me in the movie.
Yeah, and I heard that you were getting a little bit of flack for that, but, you know, isn't that really up to you? I mean, who do you want to portray you, right?
Yeah, it is, and I felt that Nick, all the way around, was the best person for me,
mm-hmm.
Not only for his acting skills, but just for his all-around skills and his people personality, you know. He's one of those people that connect with the people, and I didn't feel that the other guys connect.
All right. Well, looks like we're out of time, Rick. I know you got to jump and go to the Adam show, but thanks for the time so much, and I'd love to have you back on in a couple of weeks. So, once again, thanks for the time. I'll be sure to plug all the things on my website. So, thanks, Rick. I'll let you run so you can get over to the other show, and keep up the good work, buddy. I'll be in touch.
All right, thanks, Jake.
Yeah, buddy. So there he goes, everyone. Freeway Rick Ross, the real Rick Ross, not the fake fat rapper that's out there. So once again, everyone, hey, thanks for listening. Get a friend, get informed, and get involved, and let's try to change the paradigm, and let's start doing some things that matter. Thanks for listening, everyone.